For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Wonderful to breathe together and sit together, forming this practice body, embracing the cloud and the zendo. Thought I'd say a few things. First of all, thank you to Anastasia for offering to do flowers and creating beautiful adornments for our temple space. And I think some of you know, but I'm going to be out of the Zendo, out of Chicago for the month of February, beginning tomorrow. And I want to thank our wondrous Tantos, Ishin and Douglas, who will be in charge, but also just a great encouragement to all of us that how lucky we are at Ancient Dragon to have a place where there are so many deep, settled practitioners. You know, Douglas and Ishin are both Dharma entrusted Zen teachers, Dharma transmitted, you might say, which means they carry the tradition for us. And so it's really a great thing. So then new people can come in and don't have to worry about anything because you've got these older folk taking care of the shop. So it's really wonderful. So thank you, everyone, for being here today and practicing. You know, we developed this body of practice in Zazen, a body that's warm-hearted, counter to some propaganda about Zen. This is a warm-hearted practice first, compassion first. And it's a body of kind of boundless inclusivity and wholeness. So don't be afraid to care about the world. It's okay. As a matter of fact, it's essential. It's a feature of our family style of practice. In the great tradition of Buddhism, our family style is bodhisattva caring. This kind of boundless dedication to the well-being of all life, including our great Mother Earth and trees and pebbles and plastic. We care for all of it, Democrat or Republican. It's a great challenge, I know. So, I'm going to try to make this talk brief today because I know you're probably tired of me talking about the breath. But also, after announcements, everyone will exit the Zendo, and instead of rolling right into work period and tea, there's going to be a little break time, and those who wish are invited to come back into the Zendo. And both online and in person, after everybody exits, you may return, and we'll have a brief memorial service for the great teacher and abbot of Berkeley Zen Center, our great dragon friend, actually, Hozan Allen Sanaki. So for those of you who have not encountered Hozan in this life, Hozan spent his entire life not being afraid to care. he truly lived a life of embracing and sustaining all beings, a life of a bodhisattva. And, you know, I never want to say what something is. You know, Suzuki Roshi used to say, the most important point or the most important thing is, and he said that thousands of times, so that kind of undercut holding on to things. So if I say something about what a bodhisattva is, remember, it's only tentative. But a bodhisattva, for our purposes, let's say today, is a human being, us, you know, who seeks to awaken completely, thoroughly, diligently, lovingly, for the benefit of all. And so a bodhisattva vows to show up in the world and meet ignorance, hatred, and suffering with caring, kindness, and attention. With a kind of caring, kindness, and attention that is skillful in the moment and heart-based. We don't cut off our brains, but we stay resident in a wise heart in response. This caring, attention, and kindness, these bodhisattva flavors, are based on this deep knowing of reality as it is, when it's not clouded by dualism, distraction, you know, the latest hit of dopamine when you open an app, confusion and selfishness, which seem to be motivating quite a few people these days, sadly, but our job, should we accept it, is not to be clouded by dualism, separation, confusion, self-preoccupation. I heard someone who's an addiction specialist speak recently, and she said, narcissism is becoming endemic in our culture. I shuddered when I heard that. I actually think she's a psychiatrist at Stanford, but I think she's the daughter of a psychiatrist that I trained with a long time ago. Anna Lemke is the person who was talking about this. So Alan Hozan Sanaki showed up in this world as a great bodhisattva, working for peace and justice and, dare I say, democracy. Now, he passed away on December 22nd, and he crossed over to the other shore. So I guess it's up to us, those of us who are up for it, to carry his work on for peace and equity and justice. So today, after this talk, we'll just do a very brief ceremony, maximum 10 minutes, probably less, to remember and honor Hozan. And then we'll put away our altar for him, but keep him in our hearts. So I think everybody in this room has heard that I have been encouraging the exploration of the breath in our sitting meditations and in our life. So I'm not going to go over too much of this, but I'll just say that the more you sit zazen, the more you realize that life is breath, that all life is just this moment, just this person, just this breath. And breath itself is a great teacher of peace. You know, many of you have heard of the great teacher of engaged Buddhism, Thich Nhat Hanh, who also passed away a couple years ago. Time is a mess for me these days. But I think Thich Nhat Hanh taught that breath awareness is a key to peace. Walking with your breath is a key to peace. He kind of even won a Nobel Prize for that. So, I'm sorry if you've heard all this before, but a settled, concentrated, non-distracted heart, body, and mind show up fully to the present moment with clarity, compassion, and creativity. Mm. We even have a Zen Creatives now. Just popped up like a lotus out of our Sangha. But, you know, I think it's because the more you sit Zazen, the more you're in touch with creativity as a requisite almost, or a part of the blooming of compassion. Maybe at its core, compassion is a creative act. When Zazen responds compassionately, the ego isn't in the way. So I think what I want to share today is a little weird, but has anybody heard of an app called OneSec? S-E-C, like second. I don't know, maybe it's new. Somebody told me about this recently. Somebody who's a meditator of quite a bit of skill, and said, this is changing my life. And I said, well, tell me what this is all about. Have you heard of this? You will be very interested in it, Jerry, because she's been very interested in the use of technology to distract us. So this is an app that creates some friction between opening other apps, in particular social media, but for me it could be books, let's say. You know, like TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, news media. And so when you try to click on your app on your phone, and I guess you can put it in your browser if anybody uses laptops these days, probably on your iPad too, when you do that thing, you know, it pops up, this app pops up first. You don't have a choice because you programmed it this way. So that was your choice. And it creates this friction, right? And guess what it uses to create friction?
The breath.
So this thing pops up and says, before you can open anything, you have to take a breath. And it shows like, breathing in and exhaling. And then it's like, do you really want to open this? You've opened this 12 times today. Is this what you really want to do? Is that question? Now, it doesn't take 1 sec to take a breath. It probably takes maybe like 10 seconds, which is an eternity, right? When you're, you know, if your phone takes 10 seconds to do anything, you think it's a brick and throw it away. But this app opens and guides you through a breathing experience, just a breath. And then it says, you reflect upon what you're actually doing right now. Doesn't this sound like Zen practice? Like, you know, this is our practice. What are we doing right now? Are we aware? So, do you really want to open TikTok right now? You might be like, hell yeah. You know? Or that 10-second pause might be enough to be like, that's too much effort to even, you know, open that. I guess I'll go back to cooking dinner or something. But then you might be like, no, I want to open that app. Give me some dopamine, you know. So that's all okay. Just, it makes you a little more aware of what you're doing. And Zen is kind of based on the fact if we're really aware of what we do, what we're doing, we can change the world with that awareness. And we also change the world with the lack thereof and our choices. So on the website, this is how it was described. One sec offers the great advantage that you can recapture your free will. Sounds like somebody's reading philosophy or something. You know, what happened to my free will? You can really decide how you want to spend your time. This already cuts down on screen time significantly. So this is apparently an upgrade from like Screen Time and some of those other apps that don't seem to quite work. Maybe this one doesn't, I'm not sure, but my friend said they were really surprised. Said on top of that, the long-term effects kick in when you get annoyed and upset about one sec. So like you're kind of like a little frustrated, right? Like I want my dopamine now, not in 3 seconds later. And this app is like, and even if you try to turn it off, you've got to like scroll through and, you know, this is kind of a problem. But it says, one sec is supposed to be annoying. By adding additional friction to opening certain apps, your brain rebalances those dopamine on-demand effects that Instagram or X, aka Twitter, usually provide. So after some time, you will notice that your urge to open those apps declines and really helps you to think less about those apps, which results in lower screen time usage in general. That's the claim. I haven't tried it, but I think I will. It also gives you your spirit animal for app usage.
Oh, wow.
Mine ended up being a polar bear, but, you know, it said I was doing really good because I look at social media less than 2 hours per day. Like that was the lowest choice, less than 2 hours. It headed up to like, you know, 19. Yeah. But probably if they did age norms, it would be different because as an older person, I didn't quite get addicted early enough to these things to really get that interested. But, so I recommend and have been encouraging everyone to follow the breath and count the inhalation and exhalation. Now, one sec doesn't say count. It just inhale, exhale, and shows you on the screen. So my suggestion to be aware of your breath or count your breath might be annoying. But once you get past the friction, see what happens. You know, give it a whirl. That's why I'm like, don't stop at one. Wait till you can actually get all the way to 10, even if it takes 10 years. You don't even need an app. You know, you can just breathe in this moment, breathe compassion in this moment, and wake up to your heart's request. Am I in accord with my innermost request? What I know is right? Or am I about to go in the dreamland of dopamine? Dopamine-fueled distraction. Little discomfort, little dopamine. And look what's happened. But the choice is yours alone. Want to wake up? Want to cause more suffering? Maybe a little more suffering today, not that much. You bargain with it a little. But I say, remember first this innermost request, what brings you here, what really is important in your life. Or remember the Bodhisattva vows. Remember to care. Don't be afraid to care in this moment. Care for this life, for this world as it arises and ceases. So I shared this Thursday morning, but I will invoke our American ancestors, who are actually English, British, I believe, Pink Floyd. And Pink Floyd counseled, breathe. Breathe in the air. Don't be afraid to care. Leave. Leave all your distractions behind. But don't leave me, the real me, the boundless me. Look around and choose your own ground. You know, we all have to stand on our own ground and decide whether what our finger's doing. You know, our finger can point to the sky and to the earth, or it can point at our devices. So, next month, we'll have, so March, at the end of March, we begin our annual spring practice commitment period, PCP, sounds like a drug, but it's a wholesome one that's open to everyone. And this is a 2-month period where we have intensified non-residential practice. You know, it used to be that, like, you'd have to run to a monastery to do intensive Zen practice. But actually, we are living in this world, and we don't have to go anywhere. But we can support each other in doing just a little more Zazen, committing to a little more Zazen, committing to a little bit more study of the Dharma, a little bit more practice as Sangha. So during this practice commitment period, which is our version of an on-go, for those who know that term, we collectively support each other. And, you know, the PCP is a little bit like an old school Zen one sec app, because we're reminded to pause, to deepen and clarify our choices in the midst of life, our everyday life. And the theme for this is compassion's way, the teachings of 3 modern American Zen teachers. And these teachers are Joko Beck, Blanche Hartman, and Darlene Cohen. Maybe you never heard of them, or maybe you know them really well. But that's what we're going to study, and they're all mothers and grandmothers, and they're all deceased, but they all are very powerful teachers that have given us this wonderful legacy of how to breathe compassion, how to live the bodhisattva way. And we have a bit of time to discuss, and then we will have some announcements, exit the sendo, and return, if you wish, for a little bit of chanting of the Dai He Shin Dharani, all you Dai He Shin Dharani fans. So thank you all very much. Hope it didn't annoy you too much. So anybody have anything you'd like to share or comment on at this stage of our game? Eve Bodhisattva.
Yeah. I have a question and a comment.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, Alan Snocky came here, right, like mm-hmm. 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and he sang for us, right? That was him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's a musician and great musician, actually.
Yeah.
He's kind of a bluegrassy kind of person, I think. Folky.
So I just remember, yeah, he was sitting where you were, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. And anyway, the comment was, there's something when I was sitting and counting, and I did count, and thank you for that instruction. I have found it helpful. But, you know, one thing I remember that, like, and I remember sort of remembering it before and then forgetting it, about my younger self, is there was a one point, it was maybe 6, and, like, I remember thinking that I could hold my breath for a long time.
Yeah.
Because I thought that I wasn't breathing when I wasn't aware of my breath. And eventually,
That's an interesting Zen teaching. If you're not aware that you're breathing, are you breathing?
Anyway, I think I eventually figured out that, yeah, I was breathing, even if I was paying attention to it or not.
Like Buddha nature, we're all really awakened and endowed with the wisdom and virtues of all Buddhas, but sometimes we don't realize it. So how do you live when you're actually realizing that with every breath, every step, every action?
And I think maybe it has something to do with narcissism too, that there's stuff that goes on even if you're not paying attention.
Yeah, that's right. It's not all about me. But, you know, developmentally, a young child, even adolescent or very young adult, narcissism is developmentally appropriate. Hmm. You know, your brains are kind of configured to think everything's about you. Mm-hmm. Some people actually grow up, and that's what practice is, maybe becoming an adult.
Thank you.
And thank you, Eve. In the back there, Jake.
Two very small things. One, the app seems like an excellent way to break up habit energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just to really promote mindfulness, so I greatly appreciate the information on that. And then in my own practice, I've just found that your recent points about breathing have really brought me a lot of joy in the breath and in the intimacy and in the trust of the breath. So I just wanted to say thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's also perfectly great to enjoy your breath. Or to be annoyed by it, too. But it is sustaining, and if this practice makes you more crazy, don't do it, you know. But stay with it a little bit of the friction. You know, that habit energy that we have is very strong, and it's not a personal fault. You know, this is just sort of our wiring as human mammals, but we're in a particular time and place in our culture where it's extremely difficult to interrupt habit energy, and billions, trillions of dollars are being spent, wasted in some ways. I'm like, you know, maybe I should go to OneSec and say, hey, can we get a cut? I just was advertising your app, you know, but I mean, you know, like so much money and energy is spent commodifying our attention and really manipulating our choices. And it's very hard to resist that, you know. So breathing, staying concentrated is one thing we have all the time. You know, like when you're a child, sometimes somebody says, when you're mad, take a breath. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to take about 10. And if we're lucky, we'll not be sucked in to the dopamine vortex. You know, it's normal for the body to have dopamine, and it's essential. But when you have these very powerful chemicals in the body and brain that are distorted, you know, deformed, and their natural healthful functions are interrupted by this technology. And I'm not a Luddite by any chance or means. I love technology, but, you know, it's like somebody, I'm sure when they smashed the first atom, thought it was a beautiful idea, amazing, you know, and then what? Let's build a bomb. I wonder what happens if we set this off. You know, a lot of this is somewhat innocent until it's not. So, sorry to go on. It might seem too, you know, opinionated, but I'm open to suggestions. Yes?
But I just want to comment that the last comment, you know, about enjoying your breath.
Yeah.
So we can get dopamine from that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need that.
Probably other things, too, like oxytocin, where we want to connect to people and love people, you know, that's great. You know, just don't try to grab on or push away and that's difficult. Kirsten, I see your golden hand.
Thank you, Hogetsu, for your talk. I had a question that I imagine can't be answered, but I've noticed recently that in this sort of seascape of cruelty that we've spoken about before together, we've also started to see new forms of leadership arise. Leadership that's always been there, but it's almost as if it's leadership that is most appropriate to this time. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of the Bishop Marian, right, who so many of us have started to, I wouldn't say depend upon, but started to acknowledge and recognize that she put into words with great bravery some of what a lot of us would also like to do. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts on the connection between compassion and sort of the, not just the appropriate response to this time, but is there a connection between this rise in spiritual leaders to care for people who are hurting, but also, and I guess this is more on you, I'm sorry, the fact that underneath cruelty must reside an intense amount of pain. So I think it was James Baldwin who said, perhaps sometimes people can't stop being cruel because they'd have to face their own pain.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if, do you sense that something like that is happening today? Just spiritual leaders coming up, using what they know, what they're trained in, which is compassion, to offer us guidance, but also a recipe book and how to respond to this junk.
Well, there's a lot there, Kirsten. I'll say this. Mahayana Buddhist literature, and really all Buddhist teachings, the Dharma, is a giant recipe book for dealing with suffering. I'll also say that I've been thinking recently, and I'm not fixated on this, but I keep wondering, when you said a new form of leadership, I was also thinking a new form of political leadership, at least in this country, that is appropriate to the actual circumstance. And this is not what I want. But how long did we think we were going to get away with it, with the comfort that we have, that we'll do anything, you know, to be comfortable? I've tried something like not using plastic. So convenient, right? I want to vomit every time, practically, I use it. But our practice teaches us how to be sickened and still take care of the plastic and put it in recycling, thinking about ways that we can do things a little differently. You know, how much more stuff do we need? You know, do we need more money? And if we get rid of certain people and bring other people in, that this is going to make us happy? I mean, you know, I'm sorry, I could go on the soapbox for too long, but, you know, I'm like, well, maybe we get the spiritual leaders that we deserve, but also there was a huge vote for cruelty. And maybe that's also self-healing, that when it looks so ugly, we'll finally be able to be like, maybe we could do it differently. Maybe we can live differently. And I think our practice offers that possibility, and we can't know or grab onto it. We have to respond to the moment with each other and not hate people if they use plastic or not, or if they're driving around in fancy vehicles or not. And this is very difficult, Kirsten. So yes, it's great if certain leaders are rising, you know, but it's just, you know, sort of the job in all times. It's just this time we're actually almost like waking up to what things really look like in this world. Like, it's sort of unbelievable in some ways. You know, I will be going to Mexico, to the Mesoamerican Reef tomorrow. And I'm already grieving the destruction of that reef, which is like 80% of what it was when I was a child. So in my lifetime, and many of us who are older have seen things disappear, even healthy food, you know. So there's a lot of pain around how do we be with it and not get caught in dualism, and also how do we make the compassionate choice instead of like, boink, or convenience, more convenience, more convenience. Oh, no. And don't be hard on yourself if you're caught. Just know it. Then find your spirit animal and take care of it. So thank you, Kirsten. Lou, Bodhisattva.
Thank you for the talk. You're talking about the breath caught me in an interesting place last week because I was getting over a cold and my sinuses were aflame and it hurt to breathe.
Yeah.
And I almost asked, how do I meditate and concentrate on the breath when it hurts to breathe?
Mm-hmm.
The air felt sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, I was thinking about that. And what occurred to me was that a little bit like six-year-old Eve, the body will breathe anyways. And it was interesting to go through a time where I couldn't take joy in the breath because it was actively painful.
Mm-hmm.
And as I looked for ways to ameliorate that, I found that I was at home wearing a surgical mask because the out-breath warming the air helped me do an in-breath, and I kind of realized the act of breathing, you know, with a little adjustment could also help itself. And so I thought that was a little bit just of an interesting, as I was focusing on the breath and trying to think about it in the terms that you were setting forth, it was just an interesting experience. I found more ease in breathing now, and it's almost been a relief to get back to that as well. Those are my thoughts.
Well, that's an awakening experience, right? Like, normally we'd struggle with something that's difficult. Instead, you studied it and created your own little humidifier. You know, it didn't even have to plug anything in. You just had a little humidifier there. So, and that's part of the presence. So you must be developing some kind of presence to even see that, you know? So thank you for sharing that. I hope you feel better. There's a lot going around right now. So we have windows open and air purifiers on. I know, Tig, you work in family medicine, so you're shaking your head, right?
The flu is about.
Yeah, my basement tenant has been down with the flu for a week, influenza A. Leo. Hello.
Hello. Going back to what we were talking about with, like, the rise of cruelty in the world and that kind of thing, I had an experience a few months ago where I go to a martial arts gym, and I'm transgender, and the people there don't know that. And one of the instructors there is someone who runs anti-trans protests and that kind of thing. And I didn't know that at the time, but she had just run one and she was coming down and she was talking about it and kind of trying to teach us about transgender issues and that kind of thing after class. And it was really upsetting for me at the time. But one of the things that came across to me, like listening to that with having her not know that I'm part of that group and that kind of thing, was also how much of what she was doing like wasn't driven by the desire to be cruel or wanting to be cruel. Mm-hmm. Like so much of the things she was saying was driven by things that I respect, like the feeling that you want to protect people that are vulnerable from a threat, or wanting to be politically involved and stand up for what you believe in and that kind of thing. And it really changed a lot of the way that I think about the way things are going now, because I think a lot of people, they have beliefs that maybe aren't quite right and end up hurting people, but their instinct is to be good and they're trying to be good. And I don't know, that just was really like a altering experience for me in the way that I think about things, because it's really easy to think that people that are being cruel and vote for that and want certain things are doing it because they hate people. And they might hate people, but I think a lot of the reason why they do is because they think those people are a threat to them, or they're afraid, or that kind of thing. And it just changed the way I thought about things a little bit, because it's just easy to think that people are bad and that's why they do things. And it was really interesting to me to be in a position where I could see that, oh, this person isn't bad. This is a person who's a good person and wants to be a good person, but has some beliefs that are mistaken. And so then while she's trying to be good, she ends up doing things that are bad. And like, how many things do I do that I think are good but are bad because I think I'm standing up for the right thing and I wouldn't know, you know? So that was just an experience that I wanted to share that I thought might be relevant. So I don't know, just wanted to bring that up because I thought it was interesting, and that's what I got.
Well, thank you so much for just a really great encouragement to all of us, you know, to realize that there's another way to respond even when someone is hurting you or threatening you on some level. And, you know, this is kind of compassion that's all inclusive, which I think you're illustrating, of like, oh, you know, let's not divide it into good and bad, but let's sort of understand this basic thing that kind of actually connects all of us, you know, thinking that we're doing the right thing and not really realizing what the implications are. So thank you very much for your offering. Nicholas?
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much, Leo, for that comment. I just think that it's so important. And this is my experience, too, is that, you know, most of the Trump supporters I know are not bad or evil people. And they really think that they are doing some good in the world, just like we think we're doing some good in the world, and could often be causing harm. You know, there are a lot of examples of that. Environmentalism has, you know, in the name of good, caused harm, and a whole bunch of other things too. So there's always a light and dark. There's yin and yang. And as always, and I would say this over and over, it's the don't know mind. We really don't know. And can I embrace that and find rest in that and serenity in that? Thank you.
Thank you, Nicholas. Anastasia?
It's not a question. It's more of a comment. So I do psychotherapy, and I have a patient who is a scientist, young person, well, young to me, younger than me, and they are starting to question a lot of different things in a lot of different ways. They're also a community organizer, but one of the questions that they brought, and they keep bringing these questions to me, and I'm like, there's a lot of different ways to look at it, and here's this book that you can read, you know. But one of the things that they are asking about is like, how did human beings ultimately start to be tribal? This is not about this time, what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. This time here in this country right now, it's been happening for lots and lots mm-hmm. of years.
Buddhism. I mean, anyway, this Buddhism is not, I mean, it's just been happening. No. We are just happening. It's acute now for us. But it's not really, I mean, if you just look around, and this is not even about this time.
Right.
So they are going back to, like, so how, because I'm like, well, you know, this is not just happening. That's what I'm telling this person. And they're like, well, how did we get this way? I'm like, well, there's lots of different theories on it from lots of different ways. You're a scientist, you know, you guys talk about it in this way, and, you know, it's what you're asking is more of a spiritual or philosophical question. But it's basically, you know, have we always been this way? Was it worse? And when did people start telling each other, you can't do that, you have to do this? Mm-hmm. I think it was less at some point. But then it became like a major thing, like, you know, you have to do it this way because, I mean, and that's where we are. But I don't know. So the question is, how did we become tribal? Is it a tribalist thing? Or, you know, the people in tribes go around saying, hey, your hair's too short and you need to wear it longer. You can't be in the tribe if you don't do this. We're going to lead you out for the lions. I don't know. But it's not just this time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Well, it's a great question. I'm sure many anthropologists and others are looking into this. I have a great Zen friend who's a scientist and amazing. And she said, well, this is just the way our bodies are built. We're built as categorizers and, you know, as hierarchical, you know, social organizations. And it's sort of, you know, goes back pretty far in the world. But I think this, we do need to stop because we could go on forever. So thank you, David and Eve, but maybe we can talk about things over lunch. I think it's time for us to chant our vows, have announcements, and honor Alan Sanaki and clean and tea, that kind of thing. So, I'm going to sign off from online people, but we'll still be on audio. So thank you all very much for engaging the Dharma together.
Beings are numberless. We bow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way surpassable. We vow to realize it.